The Katra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're tackling a really landmark book in philosophy, one that honestly didn't just want to adjust our thinking about the mind, it sort of aimed to tear down the old framework entirely.
That's right. We're talking about Gilbert Ryle's 1949 classic, The Concept of Mind.
And it's a big one.
It absolutely is. Our mission today, really, is to unpack Ryle's pretty radical critique of how we've traditionally thought about mind and body. He argued, quite forcefully, that centuries of debate were fundamentally based on a kind of linguistic mistake.
A conceptual confusion.
Exactly. What he famously called the dogma of the ghost in the machine.
And this isn't just some dusty old philosophy debate, right? Why should we care about this now?
Well, because Ryle challenges the very words we use every day to talk about ourselves, our thoughts, feelings, intentions, what it means to be smart. If he's onto something, it gives us a kind of shortcut, a way to see why the mind-body problem became such a knotty issue in the first place. And that has huge implications for, you know, psychology, neuroscience, even how we think about AI.
Okay, so let's talk about the man himself, Gilbert Ryle.
Right, Gilbert Ryle, 1900 to 1976, a major figure in British philosophy, Wainfleet professor at Oxford for a long time, post-war. He was really central to what's known as ordinary language philosophy.
Ordinary language philosophy. What makes that different from, say, more traditional approaches? Was he looking at brain scans or doing experiments?
No, not at all. His view was that the really deep philosophical puzzles, the ones that seem totally unsolvable, they don't usually come from some mystery about the world itself. They come from us getting tangled up in our own language.
Misusing words, basically.
Or just misunderstanding the logical way our concepts work. His tool was conceptual analysis. He wasn't trying to peer into some hidden mental realm. He wouldn't look closely at how we actually use words like know, believe, intend in everyday life.
So dissecting the language rather than the mind itself?
Precisely. He felt these words weren't pointing to secret inner events like the traditional view assumed.
Okay, so was he just a behaviorist then? Saying consciousness doesn't exist, it's all just stimulus response?
Ah, that's a common misunderstanding. But no, he wasn't a crude behaviorist denying inner life. He was after something more sophisticated, sometimes called logical behaviorism.
Okay.
He wanted a way to talk about intelligence, feelings, all the richness of mental life without needing this ghost, this mysterious inner pilot driving the body. He thought the explanation should be coherent and, crucially, public.
Right. So let's get to that main target, the official doctrine, as Ryle puts it.
Yes, which is essentially Cartesian dualism, Descartes' idea.
The idea that every person is two separate things, a physical body out there in the world, public, and then a private, non-physical mind hidden away inside.
Exactly. And the immediate problem that pops up is, well, how do these two completely different kinds of things even talk to each other? How does the non-physical mind make the physical body, you know, lift an arm?
The ghost and the machine. How does the ghost pull the levers?
And Ryle's diagnosis here is, well, pretty profound. He says this whole picture, the official doctrine, is built on a fundamental conceptual mistake.
The category mistake.
The category mistake. That's his key term. It's the error of treating a concept as if it belongs to one logical type or category when it actually belongs to another. It's like asking. Well, he gives a great example.
The university one.
Right.
Yeah, that makes it much clearer.
Yeah, the university analogy is perfect. Imagine someone visiting Oxford or Cambridge for the first time.
Okay.
They're shown the colleges, the Bodleian Library, the labs, the administration offices, the playing fields. Everything.
All the physical parts.
Right. And then, at the end of the tour, the visitor says, yes, but where's the university?
I see. The mistake is thinking the university is another thing alongside the buildings.
Exactly. The university isn't a separate entity in addition to all those parts. It is the way all those parts are organized, coordinated, how they function together as a whole system.
So Ryle is saying dualists make the same mistake with the mind.
Precisely. They treat the mind as if it's this extra hidden thing, an invisible ghost alongside the physical body. But Ryle argues the mind is the organization, the functioning, the capacities of the person as a whole.
So his positive view, then, it's not about a secret inner stage where thinking happens.
No. For Ryle, when we talk about mental qualities, saying someone is intelligent or angry or brave, we're actually describing their their abilities, their tendencies, their dispositions to behave in certain observable ways under certain circumstances.
We're describing their style of performance almost, how they generally act over time.
That's a great way to put it, their style of performance.
Okay, let's dig into how he dismantles this ghost. A really crucial part is his distinction between two kinds of knowing.
Yes, this is absolutely fundamental for him. Knowing that versus knowing how.
Okay, what's the difference?
Knowing that is knowing facts, propositions, information you could write down in a textbook. Like knowing that Paris is the capital of France. Or knowing that ENCTO.
Got it. Factual knowledge.
Right. Knowing how, on the other hand, is practical skill, ability, competence. Knowing how to ride a bicycle, or how to speak French, or how to bake bread. It's a capacity, a skill.
And Raoul thought we often confuse these, especially when thinking about intelligence.
Yes, he targets what he calls the intellectualist legend. This is the prejudice, really, that any intelligent action must be preceded by some kind of inner intellectual act of considering facts or rules.
Like, before I cleverly catch a ball, I must have quickly consulted the laws of physics in my head.
Sort of, yeah.
Yeah.
Or that to argue cleverly, you first have to mentally rehearse the rules of logic. Ryle says this leads to a ridiculous problem.
An infinite regress.
Exactly. If performing an action intelligently requires first contemplating a rule, knowing that, then contemplating that rule intelligently would seem to require contemplating another rule about how to apply the first rule.
Oh, I see. And then you'd need a rule for applying that rule.
And so on, forever. You never actually get to the action itself.
Right. It just paralyzes the whole process.
It shows the absurdity of thinking. There's always this hidden intellectual thinking step before skilled action.
So Ryle's point is, intelligence isn't some secret inner process causing the action.
No. Intelligence is a quality of the action itself. It's in how the action is performed flexibly, adaptively, successfully. It's a disposition to act effectively, not a hidden mental precursor.
Okay, that makes sense. And this kind of thinking helps him tackle another piece of the ghostly machinery, right? The idea of the will.
Yes, the concept of volitions. The traditional dualist picture sort of needs these things.
Why? What are volitions supposed to be?
Well, if the mind is non-physical and the body is physical, you need some kind of bridge, some special mental volition or act of will that somehow causes the physical body to move.
A mental command. Move arm now.
Pretty much. A non-physical push that makes the physical machine go. Every voluntary action is supposed to have one of these preceding it.
Do we actually experience these volitions? I mean, it feels like I just decide to pick up my cup.
Ryle's point exactly. He argues these volitions are theoretical fictions. Nobody has ever actually witnessed one. They were basically invented to make the dualist theory work.
So how does Ryle explain voluntary action then, if not by volitions?
He says when we distinguish a voluntary action, like deliberately raising your hand, from an involuntary one, like a reflex twitch, we're not looking for a hidden mental cause. We're describing the action's properties and context.
Like, was it done on purpose? Could the person have done otherwise? Are they responsible for it?
Yes. It's about the observable characteristics and the context of the action, not some mysterious inner trigger. The difference is descriptive. It's about how the action fits into a wider pattern, not about finding a hidden mental spark.
Okay, so he's applying the same kind of analysis, looking at how we use language, looking for dispositions to emotions as well, because emotions feel like the most private inner things imaginable.
They do, and that's the common view he wants to challenge. He doesn't deny we have feelings, of course, but he argues that much of what we call emotion isn't best understood as just a private inner turbulence or occurrence.
So how does he break it down?
He makes distinctions. There are feelings. Sure, like a sudden pang of fear or a jolt of joy. Those are specific occurrences, happenings.
Okay.
But then there are moods like being cheerful or irritable or glum for an afternoon or even a week. Ryle says these are better understood as short-term dispositions. Being in a cheerful mood means you're disposed to smile, joke, see the bright side, etc.
Right. It's a tendency to act and react cheerfully.
Exactly. And then there are motives like vanity, ambition, patriotism. These, for Ryle, are even more clearly long-term dispositions, character traits revealed in patterns of behavior over time. Being vain isn't having a constant inner feeling of vanity. It's having the disposition to act vainly in various situations.
So the mistake is thinking that when we say someone is, say, generous, we mean they have a constant inner feeling of generosity bubbling away.
Yes, we actually mean they have a disposition to act generously when the opportunity arises. Our language already reflects this, Ryle thinks, but the ghost in the machine picture tricks us into looking for hidden interstates instead of public behavioral patterns.
This all leads to what might be the most challenging part of his argument for many people, his take on self-knowledge and introspection.
Yes, the idea of privilege access. The common sense view is that we have this special inner eye, right? We can just look inside and know our own thoughts, feelings, and motives perfectly in a way no one else can.
Introspection seems infallible, at least for my own mind.
Ryle argues this is largely a myth. He doesn't deny we have experiences, but he attacks the idea of infallible introspection, giving us perfect knowledge of our own minds.
How does he think we learn about ourselves, then?
Pretty much the same way we learn about other people. By observing behavior. Our own behavior, our reactions, what we say, how we act over time.
Wait a minute. Surely I know if I'm feeling a sharp pain right now, even if I don't show it. You can't know that just by watching me. Isn't that privileged access?
That's a fair point, and Ryle is careful. He'd likely grant that we have a kind of direct acquaintance with our current sensations, like pain, but he'd strongly deny that this extends to knowledge of our more complex mental states, our beliefs, our motives, our character traits.
So I might be wrong about why I really did something, or about whether I'm actually brave.
Absolutely. Think about it. How often does a close friend or partner point out a pattern in your behavior? Maybe you get defensive about certain topics, or you tend to procrastinate that you yourself hadn't fully recognized.
Okay, yeah, that definitely happens.
We have more evidence about ourselves because we're always there observing. But it's still largely behavioral evidence. It's not some fundamentally different, infallible kind of inner perception for complex states like motives or character. We can be quite mistaken about ourselves.
Okay, so we've dismantled the ghost piece by piece. If we zoom out, what are the main themes, the big messages we should take away from Ryle?
Well, first, you can't ignore the sheer impact of that central metaphor, the ghost in the machine. He chose it deliberately, as he said, abusively.
Right, to highlight the absurdity.
Exactly. The absurdity of picturing this immaterial spirit somehow operating a physical body. It's such a sticky image, and it serves as a constant warning. Are you sure you're not thinking about the mind in a fundamentally confused way? Are you making a category mistake?
And the second big takeaway has to be that core distinction he keeps coming back to.
Dispositions versus occurrences. This is absolutely central. Understanding that when we use most mental words, intelligent, brave, knows French, is irritable. We're typically referring to dispositions, these tendencies or liabilities, to act and react in certain ways.
Rather than referring to specific, fleeting, hidden inner events or occurrences.
Precisely. And that shift has huge implications. Think about character. What makes you brave isn't some secret inner feeling you might have occasionally. It's your reliable tendency to act bravely when things get tough. Your dispositions define you, in a way.
Which connects to the third theme, I think. The importance of the public world.
Yes. The primacy of the public. For Ryle, mental concepts get their meaning, their sense, from the shared observable world of behavior and social interaction. We learn what thinking or understanding means by seeing it demonstrated, by interacting with others.
So mental life isn't radically private and hidden away?
Not in the way the official doctrine suggests. The very concepts we use are tied to what can be publicly taught, learned, and recognized in behavior.
Ryle's writing is also known for being really direct and memorable. There are some great lines in the book.
Oh, absolutely. Very punchy. He definitely didn't pull his punches. You've got the main declaration right at the start.
Which one is that?
I shall often speak of it with deliberate abusiveness as the dogma of the ghost in the machine. It is one big mistake and a mistake of a special kind. It is, namely, a category mistake.
That really sets the tone, doesn't it? Declaration of war, like you said.
Totally. And then there's this positive summary, which captures the dispositional view so well.
Yeah, I like this one. To talk of a person's mind is not to talk of a repository which is permitted to house objects. It is to talk of the person's abilities, liabilities, and inclinations to do and undergo certain sorts of things.
It just shifts the focus completely away from inner contents to outward capacities.
And that other key phrase, the one about knowledge.
Knowing how is not reducible to knowing that. So simple, but so revolutionary for thinking about skill, intelligence, expertise. It's not just about having the facts. It's about being able to do things effectively.
Okay, so this isn't just abstract philosophy. How does Ryle's thinking actually apply in the real world? Let's think about education first.
Well, that knowing how versus knowing that distinction is huge for education, isn't it?
Absolutely. It really validates approaches that go beyond just memorizing facts. Things like project-based learning, apprenticeships, hands-on practice.
Right. It suggests the goal shouldn't just be to fill students' heads with information knowing that, but to actually cultivate their abilities, their skills, their knowing how, developing competence, not just recall.
And what about artificial intelligence? You mentioned that earlier.
Yeah, Ryle's ideas were really ahead of their time there, almost anticipating concepts in embodied AI. He implicitly warns against that simple analogy of brain as hardware, mind as software.
You ghost in the computer, basically.
Exactly. His focus on knowing how suggests that real flexible intelligence, the kind we admire in humans, probably isn't just about clever computation in a box. It likely requires interaction with an environment, learning through doing embodied skills.
That feels very relevant now. And personally, is there a kind of self-help angle here?
I think there absolutely is. Ryle offers a very practical, almost anti-introspection approach to personal development.
How so?
Well, if you want to change some aspect of your character, say, you want to be more patient or more courageous or more disciplined. Yeah. Ryle's view suggests the way to do that isn't necessarily hours of soul searching, trying to find some inner patient switch to flip.
So what is the way?
It's about practice. It's about consistently acting patiently, even when it's hard. It's about deliberately building the disposition through repeated action in relevant situations. You literally become more patient by practicing patience.
You are what you repeatedly do, focusing on behavior and habit formation, not just inner states.
Exactly. It puts the power back in your actions
in
a way.
So wrapping things up, what's the single most valuable thing you take away from diving back into Ryle?
For me, it's the power of conceptual clarity. Seeing how a problem like the mind-body issue, which seems like this deep, perhaps unsolvable metaphysical puzzle, how it can largely dissolve or at least be radically reshaped just by carefully examining the language we use, by untangling the concepts. It's a powerful demonstration of what philosophy, specifically conceptual analysis, can achieve. It cleans up our thinking.
That's a great point. What stuck with me most, I think, is that idea of intelligence or selfhood as a performance.
Mm.
The idea that who I am isn't some hidden essence locked inside, but it's expressed and defined through my actions, my abilities, my patterns of behavior over time. There's something quite liberating about that. It frees you from constantly hunting for some secret, true inner self. You just are your coordinated way of being in the world.
A less anxious way to think about ourselves, maybe.
Definitely. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acatra Foundation.